Today, we will go back to real time and try to use path integrals to understand why, at least in three dimensions, the only possible statistics that particles can have are Bose Einstein statistics or Fermi Dirac statistics. So if we exchange two particles, we either get a plus sign or a minus sign. In principle, you can imagine other possibilities. Get some other number if you exchange two particles. But in our everyday experience with quantum mechanics, we see that there's only these two possibilities, and path integrals can explain why that's the case. So the object we're going to focus on today will be the amplitude for two particles to go from two initial positions at some time to two other positions at some final time. That's what I'm going to denote by A. This will be the amplitude for two, and we're going to focus on a case where the particles are identical. So we'll assume that their initial positions are, I'll call it Q1 and Q2, t equals zero. Their final positions are Q1 prime and Q2 prime at some later time, which I'll call t. And we can write this amplitude as a path integral. Basically, the arguments from the first lecture apply equally well if we have two particles instead of one. We can still write this amplitude as a sum over paths. And now the paths are paths of two particles. So we have two paths we're summing over of the exponential of the action of those paths. So now Q1 of t is the path that Q1 takes, so the whole history. Q1 with no argument is just the initial position. Okay, so we're going to try to understand how writing this amplitude as a path integral shows us that in three dimensions of space, or four dimensions of space-time, particles have to have Bose-Einstein or Fermi-Dirac statistics. So we'll work in three dimensions of space-time, of space. So in three dimensions of space, there are two classes of paths we should consider if the particles are identical. So there's one class of path where the particle that starts at Q1 ends up at Q1 prime, and the particle that starts at Q2 ends up at Q2 prime. So I'll call this class of path a direct path. The particle that we're labeling one starts and ends at position Q1 or Q1 prime. But there's another class of paths that has the same initial and final configuration if these particles are identical. And that's the class of paths where the particle that starts at Q1 ends up at Q2 prime. And the particle that starts at Q2 ends up at Q1 prime. This path, the set of two paths, has the same initial and final configuration if the particles are identical. I'll call this type of path an exchange path. The particles swap positions. Okay, so it'll be useful to sketch these paths in a different coordinate system. So a useful way to think about these two paths is in terms of the relative coordinate. So I'll call Q. Q will be the relative coordinate. Relative position. And Q will be defined to be Q2 T minus Q1 of T. And for now, let's assume that Q at the final time is equal to Q at the initial time. So the relative position at the end is the same as the at the beginning. Okay, so let's sketch the direct and exchange paths in this relative position space. So here I'm going to sketch the axes QZ, QX, and QY. And if we assume that Q initial is some vector that points in this direction, a direct path means that the relative position is the same at the beginning and the end. So Q will follow some trajectory and come back to where it started. So this is what a direct path will look like.
I'm sorry, I think we had a question in Barrio.
That's fine. He's in the process of answering it, I think.
Okay. If I don't, please ask. So here's a direct path. It will start and end at the same position in this Q space. Exchange path, however, will look somewhat different. So if I plot the same axes and Q initial is some vector points like this, if we look back at our sketch over here. So Q. Basically, the relative position has switched from the initial time to the final time. So that even though the final configuration is the same, the vector Q has changed signs from the initial time to the final time. So over here, in our final configuration, the relative position is minus Q. So a exchange trajectory will look like a particle does something and ends up at minus Q. Assume the initial and final relative position are the same. This will be an exchange path. So the configuration Q and minus Q are the same. They're the same physical configuration. Particles are in the same locations, they're indistinguishable, so there's no difference. So that's telling us that this Q space is not our configuration space. This Q space is what's known as a covering space. And so our covering space is equal, well, to three-dimensional Euclidean space. And it'll be convenient to make a further assumption. So if we assume that the identical particles experience a strong short-range repulsion so that they can't be at the same location, we will exclude the origin here. So they can't be at the same location, so Q could never be zero. That's an additional assumption we'll make. It'll be useful later on. So that's our covering space, Q, with this assumption of some short-range strong repulsion, is three-dimensional Euclidean space, except for the origin. Our configuration space, the physically distinct configurations live in a small a space, this covering space with some identifications. So our configuration space is equal to covering space with the identification of Q and minus Q. So one way to write that is, so this just means here we're identifying Q with minus Q. Those are the same physical configurations. So we need to distinguish our covering space, which is in some ways a convenient way to describe the paths, with our configuration space, which is the physically distinct possible configurations of our two particles. Okay. So with this knowledge of the configuration space and the covering space, we can write down a path integral expression for this amplitude we're trying to compute. So amplitude depends on the final time and position, the initial time and position, which for now we'll assume are the same. Initial and final position, relative position are the same. So writing this amplitude just in terms of this relative position. And this is the amplitude in configuration space. So we can write this as a path integral. And we've identified two classes of paths. So we can write this as a sum over all direct paths of e to the minus, we're in real time, e to the I, s of q, plus the sum over all exchange paths of e to the I, s of q. Let's write this in another way. So in the covering space, the direct paths will be some amplitudes for the particle to end up at Q if it starts at Q. And in the covering space, the exchange paths will be the amplitude for the particle to end up at minus Q if it starts at Q. So these bars over the A indicate that these are amplitudes in the covering space. So we can think about these amplitudes as amplitudes for distinguishable particles. For a distinguishable particle, we could just compute the amplitude for the initial position to remain the same, and that would be a perfectly valid amplitude we can could compute using path integrals. And if we want to go from the case where we have distinguishable particles, where this amplitude for the direct pass is a perfectly valid amplitude that satisfies the Schrodinger equation, and so is this amplitude for the exchange pass. So those are two different processes that contribute to two different amplitudes in the quantum mechanics of distinguishable particles. So one way to think about how we can construct this amplitude for indistinguishable particles is we're taking our covering space and making some identifications. And we're saying both of these amplitudes contribute to the amplitude for the distinguishable particles. This is not the only way we can construct this amplitude for indistinguishable particles. So what do we expect? We expect that our mapping from our covering space to our configuration space should be consistent. And this amplitude for the indistinguishable particles in the configuration space should satisfy the Schrodinger equation. But the Schrodinger equation is linear, so we could put some arbitrary coefficients in front of these amplitudes in the covering space. So a more general way to construct the amplitude in the configuration space would be we're going to have some modifications. So I'll indicate the modified amplitude in configuration space as A5. So we could write this as A bar Q T plus some e to the I phi A bar of minus Q T. So I could have an arbitrary, I could have coefficients in front of both, but the overall phase doesn't matter. So up to an overall phase, this is the most general thing I could write if I wanted to have a linear combination. E to the FI. And so based on the fact that we want this to satisfy the Schrodinger equation, we're allowed to put this coefficient. And then what we need to check is that our map from the covering space to the configuration space is consistent. And so we'll do that check now, and we'll see that that's going to put some restrictions on what this phase can be. So this works as well if I let the final position be different from the initial position. I'll go ahead and put some primes on the final position, just for the general case. So those could be different as well. Okay, so what are the consistency checks we need to do? So we should have that A phi of Q prime T Q zero. Well, that should be the same physical amplitude as the amplitude where the final position is minus Q prime. But again, the overall phase is not something we can physically observe. So we expect these are the same physical configuration. If we have Q, the final position is Q prime or minus Q prime. So we expect that these two amplitudes are the same, at least up to some overall phase. I'll call it E to the I alpha. So that's a consistency check. So we're making this identification of Q and Q prime. So these should be the same physical, the amplitude should be the same physically. And so let's plug in our expression for the amplitude and configuration space. So here we've got a consistency check in configuration space. We can plug in and see what that consistency check tells us in the covering space. Let's write this equation in terms of the covering space amplitudes. So in terms of the covering space amplitudes, we have A bar Q prime T Q zero plus e to the I phi A bar minus Q prime T Q and zero is equal to e to the I alpha A bar of Q T Q Q prime T zero plus A bar of minus Q T Q zero. And so these amplitudes should be the same for any choice of Q, Q prime, and T. So the only way that's missing a e to the I phi here. The only way that's possible is if the coefficients of these terms are the same. So that tells us.
Sorry, Dan, I think the EI phi is on the first term.
Yes.
Because we took minus Q prime. So it's,
right. This should be, yeah.
It should be on the, yeah.
This should be minus plus, yes. Thank you. Okay, so let's compare the coefficients of the terms. So if we look at this coefficient of the term with minus Q prime as the first argument, we have here the e to the I phi is equal to e to the I alpha. So that tells us that phi is equal to alpha, at least up to some physically unimportant 2 pi n. And if we look at the term with a positive Q prime as its first argument, we've got 1 on the left-hand side. That has to be equal to e to the I alpha plus phi, which is e to the 2 I phi. So that tells us that phi is equal to 0 or pi, again, at least up to some physically unimportant factor 2 pi. And so these are exactly the two cases we expected to get. So if phi is equal to 0, this is Bose-Einstein statistics, or if phi is equal to pi, that's Fermi-Dirac statistics. So the only consistent possible way to make a map from the covering space to the configuration space, at least in three dimensions, is to have either add or subtract the covering space amplitudes. So there's only two possibilities, so those are the only possibilities in two dimensions. In three dimensions, sorry. But in two dimensions, repeat this argument, as we're going to do in just a few minutes in the breakout rooms, we'll see that this argument is not nearly as restrictive, and there are other possibilities. So a key consequence of the fact that we're in three dimensions is that the fact that we're in three dimensions told us what our covering space was, and that and our configuration space, and that the choices of those spaces determined the topological classification of the paths. So by topological classification, so here in three dimensions, all of our paths were topologically equivalent to one of these two paths. And by topologically equivalent, I mean that you can do, so two paths are topologically equivalent if you can go from one path to the other path by a series of small and smooth deformations. So a deformation is smooth as long as you're not doing anything abrupt, like joining together two points or ripping two points apart. But this path here that I've drawn is topologically equivalent to another path that goes something like that, because I can, through a series of deformations, I can shrink the path and make those two paths agree. And two paths are topologically distinct if they're not topologically equivalent. And there's only these two topological classes of paths in three dimensions. But so what we're going to do next is you're going to explore this argument in two dimensions and see what the differences are. And then at the last part of class, when we rejoin, we'll discuss that. And as well, I will talk about some other, briefly talk about some other applications and other directions that path integrals can be used to explore. Okay, so I'm going to divide you up into breakout rooms now, and we will take a look at these problems. So let's discuss what's different in two dimensions. So the configuration space and covering space are basically just a lower dimensional version of what we discussed before. So the covering space is just the two-dimensional Euclidean space minus the origin. We assume that there's some strong short-range repulsion between the particles. And the configuration space is just that space with the identification of Q and minus Q. So not too much changes there, but as a consequence of that seemingly small change in our configuration space and our covering space, the topology changes. One way to think about how the topology changes is, well, we have our, you can plot here, I'm plotting the trajectories. So we're in two-dimensional space, so I'm plotting the trajectories as a function of time. And the direct path will look something like this. And we can also sketch exchange path from before. These are, as described in the problem, the paths with n equals 1 and n equals 0. So the path with n equals 2 is also a direct path. So the particles start and end at the same position. But this path is under here and over here. Is not continuously deformable into this n equals zero path where there's no exchanges. You can think of this as two exchanges in the same direction. Because if I try to continuously deform this n equals two path to this n equals zero path, there's an obstruction because we removed this q equals zero. The particles aren't allowed to go to q equals zero, the t-axis. Here we can think of as some obstruction. So the this part of the path over here is stuck on this side and it can't bring it through this path to so that there's no way to move this part of the path on the left through this part of the Q1 path on the right. They're stuck on opposite sides. We can't untangle them without doing something discontinuous. So these paths are topologically distinct. So instead of just having two classes of path direct and exchange, we have a topological classes that are indexed by some integer n, which is the number you can think about as the number of exchanges of the particles or the angular displacement of the relative position q. So how much the relative position has rotated in net as through the entire history of the path. So the topology of the paths, topological classification changes. Just due to that change from R3 to R2. That's the big change in two dimensions. And that means that we want to write the amplitude in configuration space. In terms of amplitudes in the covering space, there are infinitely many topological classes, and we can put an arbitrary phase in front of each one, basically because the Schrodinger equation is linear. So if the amplitudes in the covering space are solutions to the Schrodinger equation, so will the amplitude in the configuration space. Take a linear combination. So these are vectors. So this changes. We now have an arbitrary number of phases, and the remaining consistency check to make is that our map from the covering space to the configuration space is consistent. And so, well, what do we know? We know that if we, in polar coordinates, rotate the final position by an extra angular displacement of pi, then that's the same. We've essentially taken the final position to minus the final position. So we've done one additional exchange, but the final, we still have two particles in the same configuration. We've just swapped them one more time. That's the same physical configuration. So the amplitude should be the same as the amplitude without any rotation, at least up to some phase. Because it describes the same physical situation, the probability should be the same. So if we square this, take the absolute value squared, we should get the same results. And if we do the same thing in the covering space, we do an extra rotation by pi. Well, that just maps an, so an of q prime theta prime plus pi t q theta zero. That's just what we call an plus one. So these ans, these are the paths, are only the paths in the configuration space where the angular displacement is n pi contribute to these. In the covering space. In class N. So together, this tells us that the sum of, if I take this equation here, which is a configuration space equation, and plug in this expression that relates that to the covering space amplitudes, I get sum of Cn a bar n plus one. There should be a minus here. It's equal to e to the minus I phi sum of Cn an. And I can change the summation index. Shifted by one. And that tells, so then equating terms, these should be the only way for this expression to be valid for all choices of Q and theta and T, is if the coefficients are the same. So that tells me that Cn minus one, e to the I phi is equal to Cn. So all of these phases can be are related. So there's only one choice of phase. But we've already done all of our consistency checks. So this phi can be anything. The map from the covering space to the configuration space is consistent. And our configuration space amplitude satisfies the Schrodinger equation for any choice of phi. So these, this is a valid amplitude, and particles in two dimensions where phi is not equal to zero pi will have different statistics from the ordinary Bose-Einstein or Fermi-Dirac statistics. So these types of particles are known as anions. So if phi is not equal to zero or pi, are anions. They have, in a sense, fractional statistics somewhere in between Bose-Einstein and Fermi-Dirac. And Anions, there's some experimental evidence for anions. So they are using the theoretical explanation of the fractional quantum Hall effect. They haven't been directly detected, uncontroversially directly detected yet, but there's ongoing experimental work to confirm the existence and properties of anions in two-dimensional quantum systems.
Hey, excuse me.
Yes.
So, like, can you repeat why, how we concluded that pi is not equal to zero and pi?
If this is the case, zero and pi are, of course, valid solutions.
Okay, so pi can be anything between zero
pi
and
pi. Pi can be anything. Yeah. Pi is a real number. So of course, in two dimensions, we can have fermions and bosons, but we can also have other things. So that more possibilities in that case. Thank you, Isha. Okay. Any comments or questions on anions or particle statistics? Okay, so in the last few minutes, I just want to briefly say a few words about other directions that we can use path integrals to study. So path integrals have a wide variety of applications, some of which we've talked about, others of which we haven't, just for the lack of time. So a few applications I'd just like to say a few words about are, so one is the Aronoff-Bohm effect. So that's another very interesting application of path integrals that has some connections to what we're doing today. So the Aronoff-Bohm effect is an effect where electromagnetic fields can have influences on the motion of particles, even if the electromagnetic fields are zero in the region where the particle goes. And one way to understand the Aronoff-Bohm effect is through very similar arguments to what we were doing today, so through the topology of the class of the paths. So that's another application of topology and path integrals. Other applications, so one thing I'd like to emphasize is that the path integrals, path integral formulation and path integrals in general can be used to compute any quantity of interest in quantum mechanics. So the path integral formulation is a complete formulation of quantum mechanics. It's an alternative to formulations involving wave functions or Bras and Ketts and operators. And although in this class, mainly for concreteness and because we had a limited time together, we focused on using path integrals to compute the propagator. I want to emphasize that any quantity of interest, such as expectation values of operators or correlation functions, anything you can think of in quantum mechanics, can be formulated in terms of path integrals. So any question you can ask in other formulations of quantum mechanics can be formulated entirely in terms of of path integrals, and you can answer any of those questions using path integrals. So it's an alternative formulation of quantum mechanics that doesn't involve operators or Hilbert space construction. But we focused on one particular object that we can study, but there's you can study more general objects as well. Another direction that we didn't have time to talk about is path integrals for fermionic degrees of freedom. So by this, I mean really a fermionic degree of freedom that can be in one of two values, not just the location or position of a fermion, but really some fermionic degree of freedom. So the classical theory of a fermionic degree of freedom is not familiar, but it can be formulated in terms of Grassmann variables, these variables that the anti-commute and square to zero. And you can formulate the path integrals of fermionic degrees of freedom. So it's you can talk about the history and possible paths in this fermionic space. It can integrate over these fermionic variables. This is a mathematical technique known as Bayesian integration. So this is another very interesting and fun application that we didn't have time to talk about, but it can be the path integral formulation is not restricted to just paths, to familiar real valued paths. It can be generalized to fermionic degrees of freedom. So that's another very, very interesting direction that we didn't have time to go into. And one of the biggest areas where path integrals are useful is a generalization where instead of talking about the paths that a particle took or the history of the particle, instead you can use many of essentially the same ideas we've been discussing in this course to discuss the history of fields. For example, the electromagnetic field, you can formulate the quantum theory of electromagnetic fields in terms of a history over all possible values of the field. So the same sort of construction we use, but instead of talking about the history of a single particle, talking about the history of a field at all points in space, and the quantum theory of electromagnetic fields, and in fact, many other fields can be formulated in this manner. And this is very useful for combining special relativity and quantum mechanics. This is one way to formulate quantum field theory, which is that union of special relativity and quantum mechanics. And this is a very rich area of study that much current research focuses on, applying path integrals to the study of relativistic fields. And some of the most powerful applications of path integrals are in this area. So for example, the instanton technique we discussed in this course is a powerful technique because it generalizes more easily than other methods to study tunneling, for example, in this relativistic setting. So this is a very rich area of physics and study. So those are just a few of the other directions that path integrals can be used to study. And I'd just like to say a few words in conclusion. So first, I'd like to thank Remy for his assistance, helping all of you and helping me throughout this course. So I really appreciate all of Remy's help. I'd also like to thank all of you for your attention and questions and comments. And thank you. And feel free to email me if any further questions come up or do any further reading I'd like to discuss, feel free to email me. I've enjoyed our time together. And so I hope, so next week there's a information session on the PSI master's program that I teach in. I hope to see many of you there. If not, I've enjoyed our time together, and thank you very much for your attention.